Well, thank you very much for this invitation here. It's actually lovely to see old friends and new faces. And I think particular thanks to Rick for being here. This paper might eventually see the light of day in Antipode. And I want to thank him for his patience and the reviewers as well. Okay, let me just start. So one of the most significant trends in global development has been the remarkable expansion of South-South cooperation. A starting definition that is, this is the transfer or exchange of resources, technology and knowledge between developing countries, set within claims to shared colonial and post-colonial experiences, and anchored within a wider framework of promoting the collective strength of the South. It's also referred to as South-South cooperation, and these terms are really famously indeterminate and capacious. It covers, South-South covers a lot of what so-called traditional donors would deem to be aid or aid-like flows and activities, so humanitarian assistance, scholarships, technical assistance, debt relief and so on. But as I'm sure everyone knows, it also blurs and blends with trade, aid and diplomacy and investment. Sorry, trade, investment and diplomacy. So South-South has always encompassed a huge diversity of states, economies, practices and relationships, and that has significant implications for theorising, including in this paper. So most analysis of South-South comes from mainstream institutions and orthodox epistemologies. But critical theorists have really made very important contributions from things like radical political economy, critical security studies, post-colonialism, indigenous theory, critical race theory, and feminist theory. Importantly, Pramati Raghuram, Pat Noxolo, and Claire Match, for example, reverse this question and ask what does rising Asia mean for post-colonial theorising? So all of these more critical theories have challenged reductive Eurocentric accounts from mainstream international relations, political science, and economies of economics of what South-South represents. Most, but not all, are also attentive and properly attentive to alternative South-South re-inscriptions and exercises of power. So Gudias, for example, questions the epistemic violence of development as articulated through the high modernization narratives associated with China, India, and others in South America. While transgressing northern hegemonies in many ways, critical scholars draw attention to the power regimes and relations that suffuse the supposedly horizontal and alignment claims made by South-South, of which more below. So what I do in this paper is try to ask, well, what does queer theory have to offer an analysis of the discourses and practices of South-South? I focus on, I'm not a queer theorist, that might become really evident. And I suppose I should also maybe just put my cards on the table, as I always do, and just say I've been quite surprised at how some people have wanted me to make a more aggressive and assertive claim about, like, this is the way we should understand it, this is the new thing. I just think this is quite playful and interesting and productive, and importantly so, not without value when I say those things. You can see what you think at the end of this all, but I'd be interested to know what you think. I think it's kind of slightly the zeitgeist that women have talked about overly big stuff up. This is not big. It's not going to change the world. It's actually really important. I mean, I do genuinely think that this way of looking into South-South is really quite important. And yet, something in me resents the bigging up. Anyway, here we go. So, also known as red. So what I try to do is think about queer theory in South-South. Now I focus on the South's challenge to the donor recipient binary, as the spatialities, imaginaries and identities of the developed, developing world that this is historically reproduced. A queer epistemology shows how Southern partners are changing the hegemonic social order not only by taking their place within it, but by profoundly unsettling and transgressing it, including through tactically asserting different positionalities in different contexts. So China saying we're a developing country in one context and pushing very hard on rising power status in another. So for many scholars and activists, the remarkable rise of South-South constitutes a very welcome expansion, of course, of Southern agency. But a queer critique also provides insights into how Southern partners are re-inscribing hierarchies of gendered and sexualized others that can sometimes reinforce and sometimes run counter to claims of naturalized conviviality and more equal relations. Paul Amar is one of the few scholars who really engages very strongly with this, And who knows that Orientalism and tropicalism, of course, analyzed in the United States and Europe, forms of colonial cultural power, and disciplines of racialized and sexualized knowledge and power, but much less known on this Orientalism and tropicalism when appropriated by nationalist, state-building, modernizing, counter-hegemonic projects in the post-colonial world. You could think, perhaps, Bolsonaro at this moment. So, I suggest that South-South cooperation is these sorts of tropicalism and Orientalism are finding new expression in and through the evolving and expanding discourses, practices, and partnerships of South-South. So the aim is not to ask whether South-South is queering mainstream development. Rather, it is to use queer theory on South-South as a lens on South-South, which alerts us, I argue, to the constitutive roles of gender, race, and sexuality, amongst others, in framing emerging increasingly powerful narratives of conviviality, difference, and hierarchy. So queer theory has been previously used to very good effect to critique gender, sexuality, and human rights in the institutions, policies, and practices of development. You're probably familiar with the work of Susan Jolly, Andrea Cornwell, and many others, although almost invariably in relation to North-South development. Queer international relations is prospering, I'll say a bit more about that, and that's been quite invigorating. But development hasn't been a focus of work within the queer IR work, which is still overwhelmingly Euro-American. McDashian and Qua sort of call it queer theory as American studies. There's now a growing debate over the intersections and synergies and tensions between queer and post-colonial theories, and lots of really important and substantial literature on non-Western queer histories, cultures, and politics, the Philippines, and India, and elsewhere. These are generally set within national, regional, or diasporic frames, rather than in relation to global development as such. One exception comes from Korea and Kana, who address sexuality, gender, and human rights in the context of the geopolitical turn that's followed the rise of the South since the turn of the new millennium. So they argue, they put these debates about the South's, the rise of the South in those geopolitical scales and dimensions, recognizing then that the politics of gender and sexuality are also critical to understanding that. So they're a very interesting and sophisticated exception. So all of these literatures constitute some of what Osman calls the discernible global shift turn in queer studies. And what this paper shares is the desire to deprivilege and decenter the metropolitan, to challenge assumed hierarchies of leading and backward spatialities of queerness, whether big city versus rural, or as in this paper, the first world versus the third world. So here the South is not a passive, feminized recipient of aid, but actively queering development hierarchies, albeit in ways that don't evade southern reproductions of gendered and sexualized others. So I want to talk about two main ways in which queer epistemology can bring more a different sort of understanding to complex this complex phenomenon. So the first is around definitions and categories. The queer theory emerged as a radical response to gay westernized movement. Proponents argued that dominant strategies and approaches characterizing LGBT activism are based on an assimilationist politics of liberal identity and rights that leave heteronormativity essentially intact. So the negative valence of deviant sexuality is supposedly dissolved, but individuals remain in unplanned categories which are enrolled in existing social norms. Gay marriage would be the perfect example. So similarly, the celebration of the pink pound and urban boosterism, appropriating gay spaces of leisure and sociality, Canal Street, Soho, embody the reductive logic of capitalist consumption and citizenship. LGBT individuals are validated through their ability to consume and provide energy and new marketing niches for global capital. So the charge that liberal normativity has de-radicalized the dissident politics of alternative sexualities and gender identities has taken on a geopolitical dimension in the work of Qua, Wilcox, Weber, and others. For example, examining homo-nationalist discourses around gay-friendly societies and militaries, which are leveraged to the notion of more advanced or civilized nations and cultures. So drawing instead on the destabilizing possibilities of pro-structuralism, I'm sure you all recognize, Dana International and Conchita Bus. Queer theorists assert fluid identities and practices of sexual orientation and gender identity in ways that unsettle and transgress norms of social orderings of international society. So queer theory has been critiqued for its Eurocentricity and its whiteness, with some arguing that it's intensive or even epistemologically capable of dealing with intersectional subjectivities and the material conditions that produce marginality and oppression. And these are debates that are very much ongoing. Ilan Kapoor provides a rare exception to queer theory's neglect of global development. And in a huge paper that I've just barely touched on here, he suggests that queer and third world can be brought together through what he says is their common inheritance of subjugation and disparagement, and their shared allegiance to the non-alignment and a politics aimed at disrupting domination and status quo. So queer and third world, those are disparaged, subjugated, and resist the idea of alignment and domination. So Kapoor references classic work by Pintock and Stoller and others on how the West has consistently imagined and framed the third world as deemed perverse and abnormal, and very frequently as effete, feminine and passive. He argues that the international development regime has inherited the legacies of colonial queering of the third world, relying on pathologized binaries in its determination to straighten out poor countries. Feeble economies must be disciplined by a dose of externally administered austerity, while perverse polities are restrained and retrained, and the tutelage of donor states driving good governance. He cites Mark Duffield on the security development nexus and construction of violent borderlands as places of excess, unpredictability, and violence. And from the sick bodies of third world states and citizens flow disease, crime, refugees, and terror. And the paper does a lot more, but what I want to point to here is that Kapoor's invocation of the geopolitical is important for this paper. What he argues is the non-conformity of the third world, expressed in events like the Bandung Conference in 1955, and the non-aligned movement, which was established in 1961, and their legacies, are examples of how southern states and platforms have sought historically to contest and destabilize dominant international norms. So, Kapoor is a rare exception in taking queer theory into the realm of non-Western geopolitics. But his main axis actually continues to be that of North-South development, First World, and World. What I want to do is examine what queer theory offers to a critical analysis of this alternative axis, if you like, of South-South. So I'll start, as I mentioned, with the taxonomies of development, the normative taxonomies. So South-South, if this was has been the, if you like, the axial representation of development and symbolic dimensions for most of 60 years, South-South has grown rapidly from the early to mid 2000s. In terms of material resources, visibility, and ideational power. So development is now being led by new actors with different ideas, cultures, and conducts. New geographies of power are on show in emerging forums and platforms of South-South diplomacy, and they're increasingly ripping through mainstream development institutions, foundations, think tanks, bilateral donors, and so on. So-called traditional donors 10, 15 years ago were watching with various degrees of admiration and alarm as China and others began to expand their diplomatic relations, investments, and influence in partner countries. So Moshe Tanaim represented the hostile end of the spectrum, asserting that China, Saudi Arabia, and Venezuela were rogue donors using toxic aid in pursuit of their revisionist agendas. Benign, these southern development partners were transmitting their pathologies and deviancy to other parts of the global south through the vectors of South-South cooperation. Most recipient governments, on the other hand, were highly appreciative of the alternative and additional resources, ideas, and approaches brought by these southern partners, although not without a degree of scepticism. For the first time since the establishment of the post-World War II era, the international development regime could be said to be provincializing, as southern partners challenged the assumptions about the rightful direction of knowledge and authority, provided new models and aspirations, and instead of being a place of discipline and tutor, a source of sick bodies and dangerous disorder, they framed the third world as a site of positive energy, opportunity, mutual benefit, and science, technology, and policy advancement. So it's really striking, but not surprising, that the initial responses within the mainstream development community and Western media were varied, but very often distorted by intractable misunderstandings over terminology, typologies, and definitions. Most commentators started with the premise that the rising powers, usually the BRICS, then some others, were becoming new donors, providing aid to poorer countries. And many Western commentators had no other frame of reference than that of the hegemonic model of donorship and aid and richer to poorer transfers. Particularly in the case of China, the misnaming and thus the miscalculation, the blurred and blended flows of aid like finances, investment and trade, led to alarmist narratives of a massive flows of Chinese aid being used for devious purposes. Like other southern partners, many of China's development cooperation activities and vectors quite explicitly blur and blend commercial and geopolitical geostrategic logics. These flows of expertise, loans, technology, investment are not just intertwined, they are co-constituted in diplomatic speeches and statements, in project praxis, in institutional embedding, and in the technocracies of accounting lines and financial monitoring. So the conceptual framing of Western aid is a distinctive category, supposedly insulated in form and purpose from other flows, fails to capture or define a set of principles and practices that emerge from a very different historical and cultural trajectory of South-South. Similarly, China and other sovereign states claim alternative ethical principles, respect for sovereignty, the dignity of mutual benefit, and reciprocity, and so on, were unrecognized or disregarded by people who couldn't grasp the more heterotopic field of foreign policy ethics. So there are some appropriate parallels and comparisons to make between North and South, but the conceptual and institutional apparatus of the hegemonic development regime proved initially, at least, just simply inadequate, unable to name, define, understand, and compare Southern development cooperation. It was thoroughly queer. Mitzi argues that queer theory offers methods of imagining difference on its own terms. Researching and explaining difference of South-South cooperation on its own terms has been a role played by Southern scholars and interlocutors and some critical researchers within the West. Retaining a critical perspective, while resisting inappropriate parallels being drawn between aid and development cooperation has been one such task, and sometimes this has been in the face of ignorance and hostility, but also just a more pervasive inability to see tenacious normative assumptions that naturalize Western donors in the paternalistic role of provider and Southern states in the position of grateful or unruly or deviant recipients. So despite assumptions and efforts towards co-option, in fact, over the last 10 to 15 years, Southern partners have successfully resisted attempts to assimilate them within this normative bordering of development hierarchies around knowledge and legitimacy. Brazil, India, Turkey, and Thailand, and many others are now recognized sites of development knowledge production. They're translating and transferring programs, techniques, and resources in fields as diverse as humanitarian response, energy infrastructure, agricultural modernization, and so on, with varying degrees of success, as we said. So Southern partners are increasingly collaborating and cooperating with the established donors, but for the most part on their own terms and while retaining ideational and ontological distinctiveness. If anything, it's the North that has shifted more in the direction of the South in terms of narratives and tools and approaches in the last 5 to 10 years than the other way around. So the first part of my talk suggests that the growth and consolidation of South-South cooperation has meant that the specialities, imaginaries, and identities of global development, who does who to what, with what knowledges and so on, have not just been upended, but positively queered, unsettled by non-conforming definitions and by the hybridized flows that transgress established categories. The second way of looking at queer theory and South-South is through race, gender, and sexuality. So deconstructing hegemonic definitions and categories, I didn't have as much time as I would like to prepare this, so I'm reading instead of talking it. So it's a sure sign it's the end of the term when you have to read. So Kapoor argues that the gift of foreign aid confers virility on Western donor nations, and by extension underscores the construction of a passive, needy, and permanent South. If we extend this illusion, we can say that the North tops, inserts, or penetrates, and the South bottoms, receives, and is penetrated. as South South has become more potent, so to speak, its advocates have nonetheless insisted that they reject the gendered and sexualized ordering of donor recipient identities, tutelage, and hierarchy. Instead, South South, they argue, is reflective, and we'll address the claims critically, of genuine partnership around relationships of mutual respect, reciprocity, horizontality, and sovereign equality. The metaphors and images here from Chinese posters, and China Africa posters in particular, are of families, brothers and sisters, conviviality. And fascinatingly, these can transcend state identities. So, for example, the first president of Senegal, independent Senegal, Senghor Ba, is that how you pronounce his name? Ben?
Senegal.
Yes. This is the first president of Senghor. Senghor?
Senghor.
Yeah.
Yes, Senghor.
Yeah, he very cheekily suggested that South Indians should join the Negritude movement, similarly oppressed as they were by the lighter skinned North Indians. I don't know what the South Indians or the North Indians made of this, but he was creating a racialized conviviality that actually transcended states. Similarly, Panther Love here between a poster around Black Panthers and Malcolm X and Mao. When I found this poster in the context of queer theory, it was so lovely to find Panther Love. Some southern partners, like India, absolutely reject the term donor altogether, given its associations with the violation of the sovereign body politic and the unwanted exercise of external power. A queer reading of this is suggestive. So rather than top or bottom, the third worldist narrative invokes a third queer term, versatile or versatilio in South America. Southern partners both give and receive and are insistent on that dual identity. China insists that it too is a developing country. And in South America, there is a phrase that no country is too poor not to give, and no country is too rich not to receive. Narrative framing actively seeks to deny top-bottom hierarchies through claims to share identity, exchange, and mutual benefit, something that invokes a very different image, the masculinized penetrative donor. Brazil refers to horizontal cooperation, while the principle of non-interference distinguishes southern approaches from the creeping predations of busy-handed Western donors. So following the identification of other third world countries as sites of opportunity rather than in need of disciplining or rescuing, southern partners can be courting or wooing. And this is from Paula Maher's book. It's a shame it doesn't show up better, but Ahmadinejad is very deliciously dressed in a white wedding dress, while President Lula has a cheeky look in his eye. The realities of power and partnership have, of course, always been more complex. The third world framing has long been in tension with geopolitical rifts, and with less progressive readings of nation, ethnicity, and development, including in gendered and sexualized ways. Southern narrative framings are currently moving towards a more masculinist and virile assertion of national superiority and prowess. For example, two Indian colleagues of mine argue for a more robust Indian development cooperation policy, which ought to more effectively support India's wider foreign policy ambitions of taking on a leading global role. So this aligns with Prime Minister Narendra Modi's commitments to a more muscular foreign policy and reflects in part the long-standing anxieties of the Hindu right about post-colonial and post-colonial discourses of Indian femininity. They argue that the lofty principles of the Nehruvian era are no longer the appropriate mooring for an emerging superpower. And in a conversation on this subject with a leading figure in a leading think tank, I was told with pleasurable provocation that South-South is a club for losers. For this leading interlocutor, India could and should now abandon the worldist fraternity and claim its individual status and power. A similarly robust and pragmatic language has coloured the development cooperation statements of both Dilma Rousseff, Michel Temer. I'm sure we will see Bolsonaro saying something similar, as post-Lula presidents of Brazil. The high-level language in national policy debates over South-South cooperation still invoke these attractive and strategic earlier tropes of neutrality, respect, and exchange, but there is evidence of a shift towards more nationally assertive language and approach to development cooperation. So racialized hierarchies are far from new, but as South-South has grown and consolidated, they're deepening and becoming more visible. Koudias observes the casual assumptions around the status of development in Chinese discourses of South-South cooperation in South America, in which African and Black African and South American backwardness is racialized as well as framed in terms of political economy. This is explored in detail in the Aries analysis of China's civilizing mission, called the Yellow Man's Burden, in which a growing sense of China's development role is framed by a strong, if in still some ways ambivalent, idea about its cultural and national superiority, which calls into question the diplomatic South-South language of equality. So Nyeri says that the Chinese discourse of modernization is intensely comparative, reflecting the continued influence of Morganian ideas of quasi-biological competition for survival between races and nations. It's a long, very, very interesting paper about some of the basis for Chinese, hegemonic Chinese think, views on race. In 2017, a museum in Wuhan sparked outrage when it put on an exhibition called Africa, pairing up pictures of African subjects next to African animals with similar facial expressions. After I had started this, well, actually, after I finished the paper, I came across an absolutely fabulous set of essays on Wu Furrier. I don't know if any of you have heard of this, but it was, I think it's the biggest grossing Chinese film of all time. So Wu Furrier 2, Chris Klee. It utterly exemplifies almost every theme in this paper and more. Essentially, our hero ends up in Africa, saving Chinese people and Africans from white people and some bad Chinese and others. But it's not, race is only the start of it. The actor, director said he was tired of sissy Korean actors and China needed its strong man, masculine guy. So we have African godsons here to do. Daughters, the white villains called Big Daddy, and a Chinese American love interest. So, if you want something very interesting to read about some of this, and China's what's going on in Wu Furrier around the projection of families, patriarchy, masculinity, race, geopolitical competition. Some of these essays argue actually really about sort of masculinities, even Trump's. The geopolitics, but there's a nice quote here which I couldn't resist. In the film's climax, once you start doing queer theory, you see it everywhere. Big Daddy, the white villain, tells Lane, the hero, there are only two kinds of races in the world, winners and losers. Conversation, Big Daddy gesturing to African war captors, saying to you, please die for them, switch the Chinese and he was born for them. Big Daddy replies, people like you will always be inferior to people like me, get fucking used to it. At this point, Lang, who's been losing the fight, suddenly gets up on his feet and says, that's fucking history. You know, end of an old order, the rise of the new one, and he beats his white opponent to a pulp. Now, slightly more subtle, but still revealing motifs of family, gender, race, and sexuality in common. So, for example, in 2012, South Korean President Lee Myung-bak delivered a speech, and he reflected. When I was a primary school kid, there was an American missionary who used to clean up clothes and bring them to the street. I would queue up to receive a pair of used trousers. Then he'd switch it to the third person. That small boy who queued up became president, and he wants to offer aid to countries where poor boys and girls like him are many, and declare his country has transformed from recipient to donor. It's not only meaningful for me personally, but I think it is the pride of all our Korean people. This sibling narrative of shared suffering is implicitly and elsewhere explicitly contrasted with Western paternalism and the dehistoricization of its own trajectory. But President Lee's speech still enrolls the classic tropes of infantilizing and rendering childlike third world peoples and countries, although he invokes a recent Korean history of Korean poverty and remembered childhood. Clearly the Korean girls and boys have grown up and are in the position of older brothers and sisters, able to help their younger siblings. So the language may be that of mutual benefit, but these are unevenly and hierarchically distributed resources, consumer markets, and investment opportunities for the more advanced partners in exchange for superior finances, technology, expertise, and capacity for the less advanced partners. So South-South spatio-temporal geographies of development, heavily affected by theories of race, and indeed masculinity and gender, sexuality, are deepening in their visibility and impacts, alongside the more classic objects of research in South-South, expanding resources, programmes, interventions and investments. As Susan Bailey brilliantly unpicks, South-South's insistence on horizontality can't evade the multiple ways in which individuals and countries reproduce discourses of inferiority and superiority. In her study of Vietnamese development professionals who, in the 1970s, had worked in Yemen, Mongolia and other parts of the socialist community, Bailey examines the complex and nuanced tensions between the language of equality on one hand, and the Vietnamese view that they were bringing more advanced technologies but also cultures and knowledges to backward nations. And here too we find gendered intersections that differ from the dominant masculinist ones described by Kapoor and others in relation to North-South development. Bailey notes that many older Vietnamese respondents talked about their politically active mothers as the figures who represented the earlier generation's gift of care and knowledge during the revolution. She observes that the imparting of both learning and revolutionary exemplarship are manifestations of their mothers', aunts', and sisters' devotion to selflessness. These are very similar visions of the disinterested generosity pervading present-day official writings about Vietnam as a munificent giver of development aid to other lands and peoples. So queer theory, I think, helps make visible complex and problematic family tropes that intertwine in generational, gendered, and sexual hierarchies and imaginaries in relation to historical and contemporary South-South development. Take another example. Marsha Henry explores the deployment of an all-women contingent of Indian peacekeepers to Liberia in 2007. She analyzes complacent expectations that the Indian women would have a natural affinity with Liberian women, who they were intended to protect. Henry brings the intersectionalities of gender, class, and professionalized military identities into wider debates around the legacies and reproduction of race, empire, and colonialism through contemporary South-South peacekeeping. And she observes that one of a number of ways in which the supposed natural affinity was undermined was the Indian women's disdain for what were, in their view, looser sexual morals of Liberian men and women, like more physical interactions like holding hands. So these gendered and sexualized hierarchies can run in different, and indeed sometimes in simultaneously opposing directions. Katia Taylor reports that as well as developing very convivial friendships, Mozambican NGO workers were sometimes discomforted by the more open displays of sexuality, social informality, and the dress of their Brazilian co-workers. So importantly, I think Paul Amar argues that across the South, increasingly morally conservative regimes are shaping a new humanitarian security governance regime, intent on suppressing cultural, gendered, and sexual rights. So from new security formations, which are pacifying the Brazilian favelas, to the Muslim Brotherhood's violence against gender and sexuality transgressions in Egypt, Amar proposes that the semi-periphery, what he calls the semi-periphery, we see a rising new trans-regional family of racialized, sexualized, and moralized subjects that populate the emerging global border of human security governmentality. Korea and Kana cite Amar's hypothesis that the transformation of Brazil into a global player required the construction of a new regime, a new image of rectitude or respectability that was rather at odds with the widespread imagery of Brazilian sexuality. So it's a complex thesis, I can't do it justice here, but I just want to draw out two relevant points. The first is scale. Amar is insistent that these deepening solidarities and ties across the so-called, what he calls the semi-periphery, you might think of it as South-South, rather than, say, the Washington consensus or even Beijing consensus, is no longer just local, but translating up into global regimes. So, for example, the UN's MINUSTAH mission in Haiti is, for the first time, led by a state from the global south, Brazil. As well as heading security and peacekeeping, Brazil is also the provider of a range of development initiatives, including in relation to urban gangs of violence, HIV/AIDS, health and education. So Brazilian approaches to rights and muscular humanitarianism, and its very specific cultures and histories of race and sexuality are all playing out in Haiti, something yet to be fully reflected in some of the critical contemporary analysis, geopolitical analysis of humanitarianism and development politics. Second is Amar's recognition of the importance of gendered and racialized and sexual tropes, as I mentioned at the start. Amar cites President Cardoso's former chief of staff, who opened a conference in 2000 that was to lay the groundwork for the creation of the first summit of South American Arab countries in 2005. And this chief of staff said, The first centuries of our national formation, ethno-racial, racial and cultural, as well as underlying by Gilbert and Ferry, reveal the mark of Moorish influence in various dimensions, in values and customs of the patriarchal family, in architecture with internal courtyards and fountains, in techniques of irrigation, and in a very special way, the very physiognomy of so many Brazilians. So this diplomatic event, characterized or characteristic of President Lula's outward-looking, southern-oriented foreign policy, is framed by implicit and explicit references to conservative families, sexual relations, what we call miscegenation, and racialized conviviality. These images and discourses which foreground southern flows and histories are being pressed into the service of an emerging geopolitical formation in which the old order, if far from being completely overturned, is challenged as never before. But as Amar goes on to note, sexuality and gender issues are also a point of tension within the South. Brazilian efforts at the UN to lead a ban on, on discrimination based on sexual orientation was aggressively contested by an unlikely coalition of actors, including George Bush, the Vatican, and Saudi Arabia. Amar suggests that at that moment, what he calls the Moorish transnational had conquered the gay international, as Brazil strategically prioritised its relations with Arab and other partners. That said, it should be noted that Brazil championed another resolution, which was approved in June 2016. Okay, so to conclude. So in the paper, I've argued that queer theory provides a valuable intellectual route into critically understanding and appraising South-South cooperation. South-South has profoundly disrupted deeply entrenched identities and specialities and imaginaries of global development. Southern partners have vocally and influentially contested their purported deviancy as third world recipients, and the South is now recognized and validated as a source of resources, knowledge, and alternative development practices and approaches. Southern states, large and small, have claimed legitimacy and credibility as agents of development, formerly presumed to be a privilege of the advanced North. Critically, Southern partners to different degrees and in different ways are not doing so only through the techniques and tactics of cooperation, but also difference. Southern partners have, historically and more recently, insisted on different histories, positionalities, ethics, and modalities. And in contrast to earlier decades of marginalization, in the last 10 to 15 years, they have been able to defend and indeed project this within the formal realms of global development. So this shouldn't be taken at face value, some of this insistence having more strategic purpose than correspondence to the real politique, but it has to be taken seriously. Queer theory reveals that gendered and sexualized imageries that frame projections of horizontality, fluidity, and reciprocity, rather than the fixed, masculinized tropes associated with northern donors. Rejecting the language and, in theory, the interfering presumptions of penetrative donors who show little respect for the sovereign body of the third world recipient, the invocation of an earlier third worldist geopolitics projects greater respect between newly independent polities. The affective register is one of empathy and understanding rather than sympathy and the exasperation of the paternalistic donor. Southern partners court and woo and emphasize their similarities and mutual benefits in a versatile positioning of horizontality rather than hierarchy. But there are signs of change amongst the larger southern powers in particular, and a queer perspective alerts us to the increasingly masculinized discourses of development prowess. Some southern partners are increasingly projecting indigenous national mobility, a la Kapoor, over collective strength in their development cooperation narratives. And furthermore, a queer reading shows how always woven through South-South cooperation are reinscriptions of other hierarchies, conservatism, patriarchy, and exoticization. Queering South-South provides a reminder that ideas of sexuality and gender intersected with race, class, and more, and not confined to a north-south axis of tropicality and orientalism. And the rich work that's been done on colonial and post-colonial development constructs of gender and sexuality, and the work that these perform in powerfully shaping imaginative geographies and material outcomes, has very little yet by way of south-south studies. So Oswin proposes that the task of queer theorists is not just privileged normative social orderings, in this case the traditional North-South development, but to decenter them. And a queer epistemology helps reveal the complex ambiguities of South-South development cooperation in this regard. And I think that in its focus on gender and sexuality in various registers, it opens up novel sites and routes and perspectives for critical scholars. Thank you.